Hey there, everybody, and welcome to Investing with IBD, sponsored by North Coast. I'm Justin Nielsen, and of course, as always, I'm joined by my co-host, partner in crime, Arusha Pieris from O'Neill Global Advisors. It's Wednesday, October 20th, 2021, and on today's show, we have a really great person to talk to, Lauren Simmons. Now, Lauren was the youngest person trading on the New York Stock Exchange for a while there, and she's got an upcoming series called Going Public. So, Lauren, welcome to the show.
I'm so excited to be here with everyone.
So we're excited to have you. So first of all, let's get right to it. I just want to kind of find out. This wasn't, trading on the floor of the New York Stock Exchange. This wasn't really the thing that you were thinking about as you were a little girl growing up, like, oh, this is what I want to do. What happened? You know, how did your path veer take such a curve?
You know what? By being open and adaptable to all and every situation, I will say, although I did not seek out the New York Stock Exchange, I will say the New York Stock Exchange sought me out. Mm-hmm. I have always, my background, have been in white male dominated spaces by either being the only or the other. My background was in genetics, and prior before that was architectural engineering. So coming to Wall Street wasn't anything new. But the day that I graduated college, I hopped on a plane to New York, and through the power of networking, I ended up at the New York Stock Exchange. I was specifically looking to further my skills involving numbers because of my strong background. And someone told me, would I be interested in applying for an equity trading position at the New York Stock Exchange? And I said yes, and the rest is history.
Yeah, and now how much experience did you have with stocks before making that decision?
Zero. I think people, what they don't realize so often is that you don't always have to come into a job with credentials. I think if a company wants you, they will help and prepare you to be successful within that role. And becoming a junior trader I'm not going to say a hard feat, but it's something that you learn hands-on. And it's not anything that you can learn in a textbook. It's something that you actually have to learn while on the floor, wherever you're at, trading in real time, which is very different from day trading. I don't know the audience that's listening and how many of you do that. It's a completely different thing. But I learned, while I was on the job. My first 6 months was very intense.
Lauren, what was one of the biggest things you learned as a trader on the floor?
The biggest thing you guys are going
to one of the biggest lessons that you've learned that you're applying to your next endeavors.
Well, I have two really big ones. One is accountability. As a trader, if you make a mistake, there's no hiding behind anyone else. And I think when there was a time, and I'm not aging myself, but I worked with men who did paper trades, you could easily hide trades under your table and not have to like worry about that because there's a digital identity to each trade that's now being done in 2000 anything. You can't get to hide, you can't get to blame anybody. So yeah, I once made a $3 million error and I had to own up to that. And that was my first year on the trading floor. It wasn't a comfortable situation to be in, but it was something that I had to be direct. How do we work through this? How do we make it right? And we did. The second thing I learned that most people don't know, but the majority of men on the floor do not actually trade in the stock market. These are now men who have currently gone through 3 recessions. And their philosophy is that you can't beat the game. And they look at other ways to invest their money.
Mm, very interesting. So, and just so our audience understands, how old were you when you were trading on the floor of the New York Stock Exchange?
I was 22 years old.
22 wow. years old. So I'm just thinking back to what I was doing when I was 22, and it was not that. But we don't have to go into those stories. Now let's kind of shift focus a little bit. Let's talk a little bit about what you've got coming up. And I think one of the most interesting things is this series that you've got called Going Public. And a lot of this has to do with the bringing the retail investor into this. And you've certainly been in a position where you kind of saw the high level people, much more so than the retail trader. But now you're really getting involved with the retail trader. So describe a little bit about what your series is about and what you're going after.
Yeah, so Going Public is, it's for me, mostly it's about giving everyone access to have a seat at the table that Wall Street has so often left out. And I think going public, they're disruptors in this space, as I was a disruptor in this space. And they really are about empowering the next generation when it comes to investing and being better at investing and realizing that you don't have to invest in the traditional ways. You can invest in companies early on, pre-IPO, which so often to be able to invest in pre-IPO, you needed to have a net worth over $1 million. And so through Regulation A+, which was signed into law by the Obama administration, anyone over the age of 18 globally can be able to invest in these companies. And I think what is so phenomenal is that through the power of storytelling, and not just on going public, but in general, to be able to look at companies and say, I am a consumer of this company. I believe in this brand. I believe in, you know, this company, and to be able to invest in it early on is so groundbreaking in so many ways. These companies could potentially be the next Amazon and Tesla, and they can get in early on.
So how do people find out about these companies that qualify? So is it Regulation A+? How do they find out about a list, or how do they get access to this?
Yeah, so at least all the companies on the show, or anyone that's going through the Regulation A process, you have to go through all the process, and you end up with an SEC offering circular, which that is where you do your due diligence. You understand if these companies are risky or not risky to invest in. I mean, yes, the circular is very lengthy, but I tell people that, you know, really do your due diligence. If you're thinking about investing, this is not a short-term gain. This is something that is happening long-term with investing in general. And you should really adequately take your time to research and understand why you're investing in these companies. And so what I love is, obviously, the companies on the shows, we're following them. You get to read their offering circular. You get to decide if you want to invest or not. And you also get to, the added layer is get to pull back that curtain and really see in real time what entrepreneurs are going through, which I think is a big narrative part of going public. Entrepreneurship isn't as easy as people assume. And anyone else who's going through that process that wants to go through Reg A or wants to get listed can see, okay, this is what happens at a roadshow. This is how we pitch institutional investors. And this is how we're pitching everyday investors like you and me to be able to participate in raising money for these companies.
Yeah, and you talked a lot about that due diligence part. And I guess one of the concerns that I have, and look, I'm guilty of this myself, I don't always do the greatest due diligence. Sometimes I almost outsource that to institutions. You know, I figure, okay, they've got their research departments, their analysts that are kicking the tires on these things. Once I see some of those institutions, you know, with a solid record, then I'm like, okay, they've done their due diligence, and so I'm not going to get caught, you know, in something that's, you know, maybe sketchy. And this is something that's happened certainly with a lot of Chinese names, you know, on occasion. So is there anything that you can suggest for people, you know, again, people that might not be so familiar with the accounting and financial principles, in order to do that due diligence when maybe some of the institutions haven't kicked the tires as much on some of these companies?
Well, I know when it comes to Reg A, and at least, and again, the companies on the show, off the show, what I love, yes, it is a very lengthy offer circular, but my favorite page is the investment risk, and it puts it in black and white. What are the investment risk of being, you know, investing in this company? And so I think if you want to be short-sighted, you can look at that. If you, you know, don't have the financial literacy to understand everything that's going on, Google, research, you know, understand what it is that you're reading. But that the one most important page, I think, if out of all the pages to look at, is what are the investment risks in investing in these companies? And I think that will definitely give you a snapshot of, you know, what you're actually looking at. But, you know, I don't rush the process. And it is very easy to look at, you know, analysts and to look at reports or to listen what's on CNBC or even IBD. But I just think, you know, take your time, do your research, and do it when it feels comfortable for you, not because someone else is doing so.
Lauren, is there a minimum amount, or is there kind of a typical amount that investors at this stage are putting in, the retail investors?
For the companies on going public, or just in general?
The companies for any of these regulations. I'm sorry.
They each have their own set of guidelines and rules as far as what the minimum is. So that is.
Okay, that makes sense. I mean, that it's kind of reminding me of even within real estate, where now you're having some more of these companies essentially acting as a REIT or something, where they're taking a minimum of like 15, 20,000, 50,000, and you're buying like an apartment building and you're getting kind of the cash flow. So that it's really cool that some the number of these barriers are starting to come down because it is giving access to more people.
Yep.
And just one thing that, you know, kind of comes to my mind is in 2000, of course, this is when I was first starting in the stock market, was just a few years before 2000. And of course, in 2000, we had a lot of stocks that were coming public. And, you know, a lot of times all they were doing was really just slapping .com on their name, and they didn't have any business plan. And, you know, everyone was kind of talking about the new economy and how, you know, this time it was different and everything like that. So, you know, fast forward to, you know, here we are in 2021. We've had a lot of IPOs come out this year, a lot of people trying to get access to that funding. We've had, you know, the SPACs, the special purpose acquisition companies. Those have been very popular, and even to the point where the SEC kind of had to crack down a little bit on regulations there. Do you think that if this, you know, Regulation A plus starts, you know, gaining traction, are we maybe getting a little bit too greedy? Getting, you know, are these companies trying to get funding while the iron is hot? Is that a sign of a potential top? Is that a concern of yours?
I don't think so. I think, you know, if you were to ask me what I think of SPACs, I'm not a proponent of SPACs, honestly. There's too many nuances around it. And, you know, these are blank check companies that they're looking to acquire, and they have, you know, a certain amount of time to acquire it. And statistically, if we're looking at the data, they don't usually acquire companies. And so what does that usually go back to? The shareholders, they get money, and I'm not even going to go on that long. I think Regulation A plus is different because you are getting crowdfunding from institutional investors, but also retail investors. And again, you get to actually see in black and white what the investment risks are. These are completely different from a blank check company, where they might say they want to get a company in the tech space and then might get someone in retail, because that happens. And I think at the end of the day, especially when it comes to, you know, Regulation A plus, you know, there are going to be risk in any type of investment, but that's really why you should be able to educate yourself. I think when it comes to SPAC, there just isn't enough information for me to say, yes, I would want to invest in a SPAC. It's just not out there.
Getting back to kind of your path here, and, you know, in reading about you, one of the things that, you know, struck me is the whole idea of, you know, how much you learn from others and, you know, mentorship. And, you know, I mean, I had the benefit of, you know, getting to be mentored by Bill O'Neill, who, by the way, was, you know, the youngest person to purchase a seat on the exchange, you know, back at the, you know, the ripe old age of 30. You know, I mean, he wasn't doing it at 22, but, you know, he had the seat on the exchange at 30. So maybe you could talk a little bit, because mentorship really seemed to be that thing that altered your path. How important is that for you? And what do you think is, you know, I guess the part that you can give back in terms of your own mentorship?
Yeah, mentorship is important. And I know it's such a nuance for people who are younger, like 18 to 30. And it's like, how do I find a mentor or a sponsorship as quickly as possible? And what I always say is, you know, mentorship is a lot like dating. This, you, the first person that you see, you don't say, hey, will you marry me? It's, you know, a little bit of courting, a little bit of dating, and it's a very two-sided relationship. And so while I do think mentorship is important in a lot of ways, realize that your mentors, your group will come. There will be people that will be advocates for you, and they will want to be mentors. And what I've realized at the grand old age of 27 is that a lot of your mentors, you wouldn't even, like, they don't know that they are mentors. Like my mentor, I told him the other day for the first time, like, yeah, I don't know if you realize, but you're a mentor to me. And he's like, really? Like, because that's not something I call him as a mentor, but now he knows. And he's like, well, I guess that makes sense. So mentorship is obviously important. And for me, being a woman of color in the space is so important. While I think, at least when it comes to the financial industry, every mentor of mine has been a man, and, you know, I'm very happy for that. I do wish that I had, you know, a woman sisterhood around me. And so I am doing everything in my power for this next generation to be that, because I do think women supporting women is one of the best things that we could do. And honestly, if we did that a little bit more, we would rule the world. We would rule the world, and we would probably have, you know, you guys, statistically, you're not even statistically, there's only been 22 IPOs that have gone public that have been woman founded.
Wow.
22. That's heartbreaking in so many ways.
Yeah, that's staggeringly low.
Especially when you consider, according to Renaissance Capital, between the IPOs and SPACs this year, I think that they're projecting for 2021 alone, I think we're looking at over 800 is the projection. So, yeah. Well, and, you know, to that end, I guess, you know, a lot of people may struggle with, you know, when you're kind of thinking about this whole mentorship, you know, a lot of people are like, well, gosh, I'd be taking so much from this person, you know, getting so much knowledge from them. What could I give in return? So what kind of things could you offer as advice in terms of how you offer something to someone that seems like they might not need anything?
Yep. Get out of your head. Get out of your head. I think for me, one of my mentors that wasn't in finance, I remember I did a lot of soundboarding with him. But one day I was really frustrated and wasn't really looking for an answer, wasn't really looking for his help. And I started venting to him about a lot of different things. And he actually had a solution, had a great solution, and wanted to be helpful. So the thing is, early on in your career, and even maybe at the midpoint of your career, you might not have anything to offer to your mentor. That is perfectly okay. It's okay. At some point in your career, you will be able to give back. And if it's not even giving back to your mentor, it's giving back in other indirect ways. So I think establishing that relationship, having a conversation, being okay with, some people just want to be in a place of giving and receiving. Your mentor could just be in a place of, I want to give, I want to help, and they don't want to receive anything in return. Everything doesn't have to be transactional. So again, I think the right people will align with you. It will take a bit of years and maneuvering and having these different organic conversations, but it will happen the way that it's meant to.
Have you started to mentor people? Now you've started to progress in your career. Has that opportunity start to pop up? It's eventually going to stop. I'm sure happen if it hasn't, but
it's happened already. I get blown up on LinkedIn.
Oh, okay, perfect. There you go.
On a daily basis, and yeah. I wish I could help everyone, but especially women. I try to give as much advice, especially in male-dominated spaces, not just finance. Of, you know, some of the things that I went through and some of the tips and tricks that I've gone through. Again, it's a marathon, not a sprint. So a lot of these relationships are still fairly new. I've only been in the financial industry for 5 years, but I'm so happy to be in a place to help and to give advice. And I don't want people starting as far back as I started. If they can get the tools and the resources that I use to get ahead, I want them to use that and to go on. And I personally don't want anything in return. I just really want to help and empower that next generation, especially women and minorities.
Yeah. So last thing here, Lauren. So for people that are maybe interested in finding out more about your series going public, I know it's coming out soon. How can they find out about it, when it comes out, and where to access that?
Yes, you can find all new updated information on goingpublic.com, as well as going public on all their social medias, LinkedIn, Instagram, Twitter. You can also follow me for any updates on Instagram and LinkedIn. And we will see you guys all very soon on entrepreneur.com, streaming Going Public. And I'm so excited for you guys to be able to watch and to hopefully click to invest.
Mm-hmm. I'll definitely be watching that first episode, see what it's all about. So thank you so much, Lauren, for being on the show and kind of telling us your story and what you've got in the fire. And I think it's a little funny that you're like, you know, oh man, you know, as far back as you started. Yeah, because at 22, being a man, you know.
I'm 27 now, so it's been 5 years. Okay. Thank you. I really appreciate the time today.
Okay, take care.
Thank you.
Okay, and when we come back, Arusha and I are going to be taking a look at the market, and also we'll go through a few stocks that are looking interesting. Stay tuned.
To help alleviate some of the pain that comes from bear markets, we recommend investing 20 to 25% of the equity portion of your portfolio in a tactical strategy. If you're especially risk-averse, we recommend a higher percentage. In 2008, the market declined 37%, yet our portfolio was only down 12%. Why? Because the conditions for investing were poor, so we held a lot of cash. Visit northcoastam.com/tactical.
All investments involve risk, including loss of some or all of an investment. May not be suitable for all investors. Past results do not guarantee future performance. Welcome back to the Investing with IBD podcast, sponsored by North Coast. It's Justin Nielsen here, along with Arusha Paris. And now let's go ahead and take a dive into the market. And of course, in the next segment, we'll talk about some stocks. So let's start maybe with the NASDAQ Composite. Well, since we had our last podcast, we were taping it, and the day that we were taping it, we did not have the follow-through day yet, but we got that the very next day. So how has that adjusted your thinking, Arusha, on the current market environment?
It's given me a little bit more confidence. I think it was on that, and it was October 14th. We were up 1.73% on volume that was greater than the day before. So on the NASDAQ, it qualified. I don't think we got it on the S&P, but naturally, when you get a follow-through day, it gives you a little bit more confidence that, okay, we might be changing here. We might be changing that trend. And it was not only the markets itself, but some of the stocks that were doing really well and that just pulled back, especially just pulled back to their 21-day moving average, they took off. And so the combination of both was telling me that, okay, maybe we're going to start to pull out of it. And so far, so good. We'll have to wait and see. A lot of times they'll come up, get back above the 50, then come back in for a week and test the 50. So we're still not out of the woods just yet.
Right. But it's certainly, you know, the first thing that you want to see is, of course, getting back above that 21-day moving average line, which, you know, we did on the follow-through day. Then we got back above the 50-day moving average line a couple days later. So it seems like that would kind of be the beachhead that, you know, if we can stay above that line, that would be great. And actually, for the NASDAQ Composite, we're now above 15,000 again. And so that's a level that we were above for just a few weeks before we kind of pulled back again. So if we could kind of build a beachhead right here, that seems like another area that would be a nice area of support to form. But again, we might lose that level temporarily. And that would be, you know, very normal. I guess what was really interesting, again, when we were talking with Scott St. Clair last week, even before the follow-through day, we had a lot of stocks that were setting up that were looking interesting. And It was kind of already pulling a lot of us in where we were, you know, hey, I bought a few things. So I guess, you know, to kind of, you know, give people a sense of how we do it, and everyone's different, keep in mind, how heavily invested were you getting before the follow-through day, maybe on the follow-through day, versus now that we've had some progress getting made?
Yeah, now if I remember correctly, because I think it was last week on Wednesday when I usually do IBD Live, on that day I was saying I'm starting to get a little bit more bullish here. There, some stocks are starting to set up. So I was buying there. So I probably might have been like at 20% invested before Wednesday. Then I went up to like 30% on the follow-through day, went up to 50%. And now I'm around like 70% or something like that, right? Mm-hmm. So just slowly scaling in. Now in the end, it really just, it all depends on if there are stocks that are giving you an opportunity to get more exposure, right? Sometimes these indexes will mask what's going on underneath the surface. Or the indexes might come back too quickly and it hasn't given enough time for stocks to really base or really just take some kind of rest. But that wasn't really the case this time around. You had a lot of stocks that came back to their 50-day moving average, and then others that just only found support at their 21-day. They were so strong, they didn't even come back to their 50-day. So it was more, they weren't so many that were building bases. There are plenty that are continuing to build bases right now, but it seems like, at least to me, that the first ones that are kind of out of the gate were ones that found support on either the 21-day moving average or the 50-day moving average.
Yeah, and those were definitely the ones that had the higher relative strength as well. You know, with the indexes below their 50-day moving average lines, the stocks that were holding above their 21-day moving average lines certainly were reflecting better relative strength lines. Now, let's just kind of recap a little bit too from last week. We were talking about pilot positions. How did you handle some of your pilot positions? Did you just end up having a lot of small positions, or was part of your increasing exposure, adding to some of those pilot positions? And how did you do it without getting too top heavy and driving your average cost up too much, kind of retaining that cushion?
Yeah, that's a really good question. With the pilot positions, the ones that were that I had near the 50 day, as they were building the right hand side as a basis, I was able to increase them a little bit. If they're around the 21 day, I couldn't really increase them, right? So sometimes those pilot positions, if the market doesn't really go into a correction, and I feel like this was more an intermediate pullback so far and not a real correction, in those cases, you just might have some really small positions that you can't do that much with, and you may have to eventually just get rid of if there are too many other stocks that are giving you the opportunity to get more normal sized positions.
Mm-hmm. Now, one of the areas that we were looking at, certainly that seemed like there were a lot of setups. We were talking about computer software, especially the enterprise stocks. IGV is one. I kind of hesitate sometimes, putting too much weight on this one because it's got, some stocks that were maybe not as interested in, not the high flyers that we're seeing in the computer software enterprise. But you also had computer software security, that was looking interesting. In addition to that, what was interesting is on the follow-through day, I mean, some of the stocks that were moving the most were in like materials, some of the steel stocks and, some of the, again, we've had this sector rotation underneath the surface. We had XLB, which is the materials. That one was moving up strongly on the follow-through day. Even some of the industrials, we've been noticing that the fertilizers, Mosaic is one example, that one was moving even before the follow-through day. It was, some of these were breaking out and again, getting above the 50-day moving average line before the indexes. So is sector rotation still alive and well? And is that factoring into your equation at all?
I think it is still alive and well. I found it very hard to kind of go back and forth. I'm more kind of tech related, more growth related. And so it's harder for me to go more towards the agricultural type of stocks, mm-hmm. or the energy stocks.
Oh yeah, I almost completely forgot oil. Let's not forget that.
Yeah, exactly.
That was really early on, making
it. And I'll pull the XLE here. If you were nimble and you got back into a number of these energy stocks, you didn't have a correction, right? Completely. You managed it very, very well, and you're up. Pretty good. You're up quite a bit because some of those energy stocks really took off. So in that case, if you're going with what's been happening this whole 2021, now you want to lighten up on some of those energy stocks, maybe not completely get out of them, but lighten up on them, free up some of that money and look for some of the other stocks that are starting to base out, starting to get back above the 50 and build the right-hand sides like the shipping stocks that mm-hmm. went up really quickly a couple months ago.
And that's definitely been the challenge. It seems like as soon as something starts making progress, the trends are only lasting a few weeks sometimes, as opposed to a few months where, you're getting the benefit of those compounding gains. Sometimes the moves are just short. And if you're not nimble, as you said, and kind of taking the profits into strength and then moving it into something else, then you could easily be, watching all your gains disappear. And if you're buying breakouts, this is again one of the problems that this market has had, is sometimes the breakouts, you're almost late to the game if you've gotten something that's come straight up off the bottom, hasn't really taken a break, and then by the time the breakout happens, that's when the break happens.
Yeah. Now, to answer your question a little bit more about the rotation and how I've been handling it. Now, this time around, I've been paying a lot more attention to the rotation. So it's almost guaranteed that we're going to go back to the previous environment.
Right, exactly.
Stocks
as soon as you adjust.
Yeah.
Yeah, I hear you. I mean, for me personally, I was actually a little disappointed in myself that I got in a little bit heavy quicker than I wanted. And while it did work out, you know, in my favor doing that. The reason why I was disappointed in myself is because that's how I've gotten myself in trouble in the past, you know, getting too heavy too early. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, I really try and train myself to focus on my process, not my outcome. So even though the outcome was good in this case, I was not following my rules in terms of my process. So even though it worked out, you know, that's something that I've been burned with in the past, and I need to make sure that I don't do that too often. But again, just, you know, recapping on the NASDAQ composite, because of that follow through day, we kind of wipe away the distribution count, you know, reset that. But also keep in mind that, you know, this was really not a big correction. This was an intermediate correction. When Bill was writing about corrections in the, you know, how to make money in stocks and talking about the follow through day, it was really in more prolonged downtrends slash bear markets. So, you know, we're trying to be nimble and again, stay in phase with the market. You know, today's action was a little bit weak on the NASDAQ. A lot of tech names were getting hurt. Some of the ones that had been moving strongly. The S&P 500, by contrast, was up today with, again, a lot of those materials, industrials, real estate helping out there. But we should also take a look at FFTY just to kind of get a sense of growth. You know, that is, you know, coming right back up to those February highs that we were at. And again, we kind of challenge those levels briefly in September before we topped, and it looks like we're making that ground up again. So again, IBD 50 really does focus on that growth component, and you know, FFTY, the innovator IBD 50 ETF, kind of reflects what's happening in those 50 stocks. So yeah, let's go ahead and take a break right now. And when we come back, we'll go ahead and talk about some of the stocks that are on our radar. So stay tuned for that.
To help alleviate some of the pain that comes from bear markets, we recommend investing 20 to 25% of the equity portion of your portfolio in a tactical strategy. If you're especially risk-averse, we recommend a higher percentage. In 2008, the market declined 37%, yet our portfolio was only down 12%. Why? Because the conditions for investing were poor, so we held a lot of cash. Visit northcoastam.com/tactical.
All investments involve risk, including loss of some or all of an investment. May not be suitable for all investors. Past results do not guarantee future performance.
Okay, welcome back to the Investing with IBD podcast, sponsored by North Coast. It's Justin Nielsen, your host, along with Arusha Pierce from O'Neill Global Advisors. And let's go ahead and take a look at a few stocks that are jumping on our radar. So why don't we start out? One of the areas of strength that really seemed to come on strong was the financials. So a lot of the regional banks, and this is where it's tricky because, you know, a lot of times we look at the industry groups and we have 197 of them, but, you know, we kept on going through a lot of these group names and you'd see like, oh, the Northeast regional, you know, banks, the Southwest regional banks, and you know, the super regional. But KRE is one way to kind of play that entire space. And this was another one of those that was showing a lot of strength even before the follow through day, got back above its 50-day moving average line, was crossing a downtrend line. So a lot of things were looking very strong about this. So now that we're back up near new highs, is it too late to get in on this, or is it one that you're waiting for it to take a break?
No, well, I mean, if you're looking to buy the ETF, I don't think it is too late to get into here because it's emerging out of a large base. Mm-hmm. And so it's worth a shot. You have to, you know, in the end, you never know until you try it. You try it, and if it doesn't work, then you cut your losses and you're out. Right. But the one reason why I think that it has a chance this time around is what you were saying at the beginning, Justin. There were a number of these regional banks, mm-hmm, that all of a sudden, it was probably the last few hours of the day, I just started noticing all these regional banks just starting to break out, or all right, they were starting to act like tech stocks. So yeah. That's why I was like, I started looking around like on in the news site to see like, did the Fed release anything about tapering more or whatever? Because all these regional banks are really starting to come on. Now, financials have been acting very well for the last month, 6 weeks or so. And so there were plenty of banks that emerged out, but now you're starting to see these smaller regional banks, they're starting to catch up and they're starting to break out of pretty big bases too. So the KRE has a chance here simply because underneath the surface, there are a number of stocks acting pretty well.
Mm-hmm. Now, you know, because we're in this environment where a lot of people are looking at the Fed action, we've got potential tapering happening next month. And then, you know, a lot of people are looking at next year with potential rate hikes. All of those certainly play into the hands of profitability for the banks as they get that spread of what they're borrowing versus what their lending rates are at. You know, the bigger the spread there, the better it is for them. So is that something that's going into your equation here, or is it really just, gosh, the technicals really look so good on these?
Well, a lot of times I'll see it on the technicals first.
Right.
And then I'll go back and then I'll start reading about it and say, oh, okay, yeah, the rates are going to go up. Banks are poised to do well and things like that. So a lot of times that's how I just end up finding the ideas. You just notice that some stocks are just acting well. But there is a larger fundamental catalyst underneath the surface that's pushing all these stocks. And that's always the case. The market right now is that they're really betting on that. Yep, this is going to be the time where rates are truly going to go back up. Mm-hmm. It's just a little bit, not that much, but the Fed's not going to, you know, keep the punch bowl out for much longer.
Right.
Everyone
knew this was coming.
Exactly. Yeah. So that's kind of where the money's going right now. It's just kind of shifting towards these stocks that are going to benefit from higher rates. But at the same time, and we saw this in September, you know, a number of technology related stocks or more higher valuation stocks, they're going to get hit because with the higher interest rates, that's just going to drop the appeal to some of these longer duration type of growth stocks that more depend on lower interest rates.
Right. And so I guess in a related note, a lot of people are also looking at the home builders. And you would think that, you know, an expectation of higher rates would be hurting some of these guys. But if we just take a look at Lennar, ticker symbol LEN on that one, and this one's not alone, you see a lot of these that have been, again, a little bit of this sector rotation where it was a little out of favor. This was below its 200-day moving average line, but breaking a downtrend, and now it's back above its 50-day moving average line. Despite a higher rate environment that's looming, are home builders still poised to take advantage of these, you know, high home prices?
Well, I mean, a couple of things could be happening here with kind of the knowledge that rates are going to go up. It may push people who are kind of putting off moving into another home or getting a home and things like that. So we got to quickly rush and get a home. The other thing could be, and I don't know about you, Justin, but I've noticed that LA is a little crowded and, you know, it's not a lot of places to live around here. But that being said, you know, a lot of people may be enticed and say, you know what, let me leave some of the larger, more crowded cities, go out to the Southwest where there's more land and where a lot of these home builders are putting up a lot of newer homes and for a lot less money and things like that. So that could be going on too. But that being said, Lennar is slowly crawling up. It's not showing that huge enthusiasm that I guess in the past that it had a little bit, or some of these home builders had, but you know, it could keep building that right-hand side of the base and potentially give another buy point in the near future.
Mm-hmm. And again, it's not just the home builders, but it seems to be that there's a lot of the retail stocks in that space. I mean, I was noticing that Lowe's and Home Depot and, yeah, you know, Floor and Decor, a lot of those seem to be coming on. And again, part of this is the market itself, right? We always talk about how the market, you know, lifts a lot of boats, you know, but it does seem like this is another area of strength of related fields.
Well, it's interesting because when you compare like a Lennar with a Floor and Decor or a Home Depot or a Lowe's, the charts really are saying that people are more willing to stay in their homes,
yeah,
and rebuild their homes, right? Go to a Home Depot, go to a Lowe's, do it yourself, rebuild the current house versus going and looking for another house, right? Because those stocks that you mentioned, technically and on a relative strength basis, they're much stronger than what we're looking at here with Lennar here, with only an RS rating of 63. But if I pull up Home Depot, that has an RS rating of 75, and then Floor and Decor, RS rating of 83, right? Mm-hmm. So if you're just looking at that, the story is more that people are just going to more rebuild their homes, and they may be getting also scared about the interest rates going up. So they're going to take their home equity loans or whatever and just rebuild right. their home a little bit more. Maybe Lennar is not going to do as well, or maybe the home builders aren't going to do as well because people are just going to stay.
Let's go ahead and end the program here with a look at Keysight in a little bit of a different industry. This is in the electronic scientific measuring, but really, this is a 5G play.
Yeah, so they create instruments that all the 5G companies, or really all the phone companies, as they continue to install more and more 5G antennas and measure them, and they need a test to see if they truly are 5G or whatnot. They're using equipment from Keysight. So this is this falls in the category of the picks and shovels.
Right.
So it's done well in the past. It's done well for a lot of this year, and it's starting to build the right hand side of the base. And right now, with the cup that it's forming, if it's just going to form a cup, the buy point for this is 182.49.
Mm-hmm. And you see, you know, again, a lot of times we talk about these downtrend lines that we'll sometimes draw. It was a little steep on this one. So yeah. Is that a little bit better to wait for that higher price? Also, when it did cross that downtrend, it was still below the 50-day moving average line. So is it better to go with a little less steep trend line?
A lot of times I'll just use the 50-day if I really want to get in stock as a first entry. Then you could use the less steep trend line as the second entry. If you draw them too steep, you just open yourself up to get whipped around two more. But that being said, you know, even this time around where the market kind of pulled back for 7%, we just don't have any real true corrections. Right.
So, that's a thing of the past.
Yeah. Right. Exactly. Obviously we're kidding, you know, but it's been a long time since we had one of those kind of bone crunching, get a lot of buy the dippers out of the markets or really put a hurt on buying low. So,
right. Well, and again, with a lot of these times where you're, you know, doing that break of the downtrend, a lot of times you can really keep your risk very low. And, you know, again, if you're only risking a little bit with the potential, even in this case, to get back up to new highs and even beyond, that's a lot of return that you have the potential for with very little risk. And that's usually the kind of equation you want to be going for. So that'll wrap it up for us on this episode. Thank you so much for joining us, and make sure to join us next week when we have John Najarian from Market Rebellion joining the show once again. And of course, he is an options expert that has so many great setups and things to say about the options market and just stories on everything that he's looking at. So we'll be looking forward to learning a lot from him again. So thanks for joining us on this one, and we will see you next week. Take care.
And for this week's notes and charts, make sure to go to investors.com/podcast, where you'll find details for each episode in the podcast episode section. And make sure to subscribe, rate, and review our podcast if you haven't already. We'd really appreciate it. You can also send us your questions and comments to investingpodcast@investors.com. We would love to hear from you and may use your comments on an upcoming episode. This podcast is for informational and educational purposes only, and nothing should be construed as a recommendation to buy, hold, or sell any securities. Make sure to consider consulting with your financial advisor before making any investment decisions.